2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 315. More themes taking place. Writing in May's wake. Participants Paul Swenson, Corwin Swenson, and Roy Swenson.
Environment, and you feel shorted, discontent, to find yourself in place so dreary, with cares which leave you wary, weary. Escape to realm of private thought. Believe the truth so oft forgot. No matter what the latitude, one still can choose one's attitude. When conflicts blur the course objective, regroup and seek a new perspective. Go view the mountains, seas, and sky. With awe, you'll question, who am I? And where am I? For why am I? You ought to know before you die.
We have two people coming.
Uh-oh. How do you know?
And one of them brought May with Michael.
And one of them brought what?
Other than that. It's starting time.
It is. 1 minute.
I don't think you should keep that in your mouth.
I mustn't keep it in my mouth. That's what I'm just getting rid of. It interferes.
Rhetorical question. The name of this session of Sunstone is More Things Taking Place. Writing in May's wake. May Swenson was and is the only major poet to come out of Utah. Published 10 books during her lifetime, 5 since her death. She is anthologized in numerous American anthologies of poetry. Spent most of her life in New York City. Went to New York when I was a year old. And wrote there for approximately half a century. Her work extends from poems that she wrote very early in life, while still here in Utah, and days before her death, which was in 1989. We are today celebrating her work, as well as the work of two of her brothers, myself. My name is Paul Swenson, and my brother Roy, and the work of a nephew, Corwin Swenson. We will go in this order. My brother Roy will read first from his work, followed by Corwin and myself. Near the end of the program, we will each read from May's work. There's going to be a slight pause now as people crowd into the room.
No shoving or pushing, please. you want me to proceed?
Yes.
Thanks, Mary.
I'm a little overwhelmed and bewildered with such a crowd. The moods and messages of the pieces I will read are so distinct, and the time constraints so tight, I'll have to move on rapidly. It will take concentration for me and you. In choosing what to share, I decided just to read one piece from each of the several categories of a compilation I'm working on. The first is from Playing with Words. Tim O'Toole's Spring Mornings. Everything is cool on April mornings. Toothpaste taste is minty cool on every morning. To go swimming in the pool as a habit is the rule before I go to school on weekday mornings. Smell of bacon makes me drool on this grand morning, but the strip is minuscule on the toast I eat with gruel while I'm sitting on a stool in the pub on way to school on Monday morning. I was sad, the devil's tool, on one school day at my school. In corner sitting on a stool with a cap on labeled fool. On April 1st, instead of recess, one bad morning. After school, my friend Abdul lay waiting in the vestibule, said, "Now we're going to have this out. I think you know what it's about. I saw you give Marie a kiss. You stay away, because she's my sis. I'll come down hard, and I don't miss. Best heed my warning." Now I'm grown and out of school, bonehead, hard as any newel. Have not changed, not one granule, still as stubborn as a mule. Love my Jaguar, she's a jewel. Sad she slurps up so much fuel. The price of oil now at the well, crudely put, has risen like hell. It's not fair to spoil our fun. Let's put OPEC on the run. Oil spins thread, not on a spool. Denial of pleasure's just too cruel. Let's challenge Sodom to a duel. An April victory would be cool. We'll scrub the morning. From To Be True to Oneself. At Sea with the Majority. On the stage of life's theater, most motley characters parade, play a forthright straight performance, or strut a caveat charade. Some will craft contrived portrayals calculated to deceive with flattery the vain and foolish. Conformists who in mass believe the rap that's hep will swell the numbers, steamrolling popularity. This flattens and for many dampens desire that tends toward charity. The scene of scene, this worldly act, part two of Lifespan's three-act play, main feature, cunning charlatans disguised as saviors of the day, exploiting the vulnerable, fair game for power of suggestion, with mind games so believable, their victims sign up without question. A precious few discerning souls will play it safe, make the connection that we are siblings, every one, dependent on divine direction. While arrogant majority will rule out Christianity, discount its authenticity regarding truths of who we are, the purpose of our being here, the wonders of new worlds afar, the way back home, the gates ajar to heaven with the minority. What constitutes beauty? Profusion. If weeds are uninvited guests, are flowers then hosts, all insects pests? Is it not true that oftentimes our weeds are flowers in other climes? When weeds grow rank, some nameless blooms dress rolling hills with purple plumes. Spring flowers profuse dress cultured trees, for fruit no use if not for bees. Regarding shade of some trash tree, who says it has less quality than that of sundry classic woods? True, some of these yield useful foods. Customs evolve from time to time, and food fare varies clime to clime. Get proteins from the plants you grow, crisp grasshoppers or escargot. The mode that's culturally correct and correlates with dialect may dictate what one eats and wears, but always how one feels and cares should be attuned and not reject the principle of peer respect. When our lions, misnamed Dandy, by the thousands raise their heads, and their wind-blown seeds by millions spoil the neighbor's flower beds, I'm minded by my Danish mate, these flagrant weeds, so hated here, are welcomed golden gifts of spring to all her cousins over there. What adds up to truth? Matrix for a matriarch. In spring, more likely, ants will swarm, no thought to do each other harm. To go or stay, the quandary, no space to hang the laundry. Disgruntled workers plot a coup, in secret feeding Lady Zoo, her form so regal, wings so bright. With her, they'll end the winter night. Restricted rations, crowded cell, the seeds of anarchy now swell. The discontent neath crust of calm will overcome their every qualm, and pent up anger will explode, framework of order to implode. And so it is with humankind, to time and space of earth confined, not so impoverished of mind as not to know where we are destined. How long can any state survive when bureaucrats with courts connive, and corporate power, unchecked, goes wild? Will calumny be reconciled? With social structure stratified, can wants of all be gratified? No, not unless theocracy, or finely tuned democracy, prevails, so that God's wisdom rules, and power be not consigned to fools. The welcome torch of liberty entices neighbors round about with promise of felicity for teeming masses. Shout it out. But don't expect equality. A migrant worker has no clout. There's room for every artisan who could become a citizen, entrepreneur, or businessman, and might become a councilman, eventually a congressman, lead swarming masses to the rout of native sons and vote them out. With feminism on the rise, in time we'll see female VP, and next election in reprise, conceivably we'll crown a queen. Nearing the end. All we observe was made for us. Caravan. The camel, such a curious mammal, evolved so that he grows a saddle. He plies the sand with padded hoof, eyelids and nostrils sandstorm proof. Has scowling brow and lazy blink. You bring him water, watch him drink, and hope that full, his large canteen will stretch to span the space between oasis and oasis. With just one hump and very hairy, the Hindu merchant's dromedary can run more miles on every tankful, and every trip leaves him more thankful that though the load that she can carry is lighter, she's the nomad's dairy. This high upholstered rocking chair might well be mounted with a ladder. It's sure that you'll be safer there from roving tiger or an adder. Ungainly form, no eye appeal, but wait, she condescends to kneel. Her head will bob, neck undulate, since camels move with swinging gait. For countless starlit desert miles, the way is strewn with piles and piles of dung, which future travelers will feed fires to chase the desert chill. Robes, scarves, and turbans, sandaled feet, eyes peering from veiled faces. You're number 10 in camel train. Your goal, exotic places? The one who leads the caravan should be a magi, know the stars. One needs at least someone who can distinguish Jupiter from Mars. Your boredom mounts. The swaying there lulls you to sleep, but you don't dare. You startle, panic, then you stiffen, catch yourself and hear a hissing. You'd fall if not for camel fender on each side tied to load behind, contrived to safeguard either gender, side saddle safe if so inclined. Who taught the camel how to kneel on calloused knees? How does it feel? Is it an act of deference or humble creature reverence? Obeisance to the source of light, food, water, dunes, and stars at night. Thank you. To conclude this recitation, I want to try an experiment. I will read 6 short poems arranged in a sequence which I hope will have for you discernible relevance and continuity, leaving out the original titles and labeling the whole menage Manifesto. So what's to be said for philosophy? Are philosophers known for profundity? Are great thinkers great because they've figured out and concur in what they should be profound about? If they're mainly concerned anent mystery, their views can't be strengthened by history. If desire for truth motivates their pursuit, then skill of debating forever is moot. For truth strives not with truth in the slightest degree. Is the test of sound thought unanimity? Reprobate humanity with lust to vaunt its vanity invents a god approachable. by whom it's not reproachable. The worship of science invented by man, a method to correlate data, to span the breadth of experience, inception to finish, not bound to forever expanding, not bound to diminish, is a kind of conceit which can feed on itself, with the rate of its progress dependent on wealth. Unbiased experiment bans a preconceived goal, except to ensure every factor's control. When controls, less than perfect, leave the end in the dark, integrity dictates a question mark. When PhDs go to press with the axiom fixed, they may be chagrined when new research has nixed the conclusions they jumped to, probability moved, contemplating the breakthroughs so wantonly wooed. Bright light of truth, periphery is outer darkness. It must be as this pure light grows brighter still. Awareness of the unknown will cause one to sense eternity. Trade smugness for humility. Light makes shadow, shades of doubt, or grave desire to ferret out the nucleus which makes things tick. Relationships of slow and quick, of interlacing orbits, powers, established seconds, minutes, hours, frontier, horizon, cutting edge. You be a block or be a wedge, split the atom, breach the gap, span the chasm, make a map. Common structures, cellular, atomic, and molecular, link kingdoms, species, families with very few anomalies. Explains not the complexities of infinite diversity, nor human hope's propensity, nor untold world's immensity. Perfection in how worlds connect identifies the architect. You can't disclaim ability, deny responsibility, maintaining an awareness lack. Divert your eyes, nor turn your back to all you see and what you are. Bequeathed, beamed down from distant star, the gifts of an all-wise creator, God, designer, animator. The truth is plainly manifest. His prominence like Everest. Thank you.
My name is Corwin Swenson, and I'm pleased to be asked to tape this by my Uncle Paul. I'm just going to read a couple of three excerpts from stuff that I've written. And I'm glad to see we've got a professional critic in the audience today. And it's very good to be here with my family. So I'll just jump into this. It won't take very long. And I hope you enjoy. The setting is intimidating. 50 caliber, look around, nothing can stop it. With a tracer every three or four rounds, bullets look like beer cans in your chopper in Vietnam. Love me till my heart stops, hit me on the head, I got time. Audrey Hepburn's eyebrows relax like two black mambas. Her full lips parted. William Holden said, "I believe in love your neighbor." She smiled, showing all those teeth, looking better than Jackie Kennedy for a minute, and with a throaty giggle, she said, "Oh, so do I." William Holden was my neighbor in Santa Monica when he died last year. He wouldn't answer the door because he was dead on the bedroom floor, dead drunk. I had been back in the city of the Big Salt Lake for 10 months. It was more than 6 years without booze, yet only a year and change without dope when Blaine approached. He slapped me on the back after the luncheon AA meeting as he delivered the ticket to ride into my hand, saying, "Don't worry, it's only medication." I took it as the ticket to ride the big narcotic train. Next stop, the dentist, who broke and fragmented a canine, the left front eye tooth, and proceeded toward the frontal lobe with bayonet forceps to get the roots, saying, "If I go any farther, I'll be into your brain." Sitting there staring out the picture window at the mountains, gas mask strapped over my nose, my blood all over my chest and all over the dentist with the bayonet forceps in his rubber glove, I'm snorting the second metal bottle of nitrous oxide and wondering what he does with the cute young dental assistant after he locks the door at the end of the day. And I don't care if he goes into the brain, which doesn't seem to serve any useful purpose. I'm on the narcotic train, and the next stop is down the road in the pharmacy of the supermarket. The masks, the gas, the chair, the rubber gloves, the bayonet forceps, and all the blood are just a formality. The cute young dental assistant is only here to help. "Let's get on with it," I mumble in broken nitrous American English. I'm impatient on the train. The nitrous has only brought me up to sea level. I'm impatient to get into some real heavy, dangerous drugs so I can feel a huge battle cruiser bear down on me at a good 50 nautical miles per hour. I got my ticket to ride. I'm on the big narcotic train, going into November through the Valley of Salt in 1982. It's only a 2-month ride. At the end of December, we dead end at the graveyard, everybody out, and we dig holes in the frozen ground, dirty, under a pale moon, disappearing from time to time. Memorial Day in May 2001, a Monday. The absence of love, no natural affection, desire, want, need, what is missing, real, honest emotion, emotion suspect, emotion distrusted, display of emotion frowned upon. Things which are frowned upon are considered bad, wrong, impolite and unhealthy, germs, very close to Germans, untrustworthy, worthy. Absence of emotion is honest. It is worthy. A real, honest absence of any emotional display, socially acceptable. Cold and hard, even better, considered cool. Emotion is suspect. Anger is all right, fair warning of violence and force. Violence is okay, it's interesting. Plenty of movement, lots of color, never boring, because it's over quickly. Violence is honest, except it is real, hot or cold, needs no imagination, always understood. Violence without anger is respected, cold, hard, and fast. No warning. Impossible to prevent, hard to stop, determined, relentless, respected as real and understood, and the absence of anger brings a response close to love. For here is something real and honest, seemingly without malice, like it just has to be that way, naturally. Like a bolt of lightning into a peaceful summer evening, or a lion taking down a gazelle, swift, silent, without anger, respected, king of the beasts, powerful, natural, used as symbol of kingdom and empire. Over the last 100 years, we as a people, even before the First World War, have learned unemotional violence better than the animals. Every once in a while, a person comes around who loves and tries to teach us how to love, and we kill them. Anger is an accepted natural emotion because it comes out of ourself. It is self with all the powerlessness, selfishness, inadequacies of living, dealing with life and other people in the absence of love. Fear is real and acceptable, an honest appraisal of our powerlessness over other people and machines that move real fast, hit, and kill. The root cause could possibly be a fear of not being loved, and this would be reasonable because we don't love other people. We don't know how. Fear is probably the root cause of anger. Love. Sometimes we love to be angry. What is love? Feelings and emotions. What is love? Something we know next to nothing about. The Bamboo Bed, a paperback book about the medevac chopper extraction in Vietnam. In the book, the writer goes out every day to love the Viet Cong, to love our enemy. Of course, it is much easier when our enemy is dead. Yet something in his style speaks to me like the lion and the tiger. We go out and do what we have to do, not out of hate or anger, yet out of love. It worked. So figure that out. Love is not just an emotion, not just a feeling, not just one of the virtues. What love is, what real love is spiritual. Love is the spirit. Love is the spiritual journey, the progression from nothing to where we can love Jesus, even eventually to where we can love our neighbor, until finally, maybe even love ourselves, and then to be able to forget it. Love is not just the key. Love is life. Love is the creative manifestation through everything that ever was, is, and is to come. Without love, there is nothing, only death. And it is written that death is the great deceiver because I wrote it, but I don't know where that came from. And you ask me what love is? Look around. If you don't see it, hear it, if you can't feel it, if you can't touch and taste it, then you're dead. So you may as well lay down. Lay down and slumber. Mama's boy is torn asunder. Janicean. Yes, I do love those Jewish girls. Okay, then you can get up now. Well, is this a safe conduct pass to do nothing? Just love everybody? My ticket for the train? You don't need no ticket. Just climb aboard and thank the Lord. Thank you, most holy Jesus, Yeshua, my Messiah, the Anointed, the Christ, my Lord and my God, my King. Faith alone has let you hear the diesels humming. I ain't got no money. That ain't necessary. Just climb aboard. Leave the baggage. They looked askance at me as I trudged to the train, dirty and heavy laden. I let the heavy weight fall from my shoulders into the dust at my feet, reached out, and took his hand.
For those of you who didn't hear what we announced at the beginning, what we're doing is each reading from our own work briefly, and then we will do another round in which we will read from the work of Mae Swenson, the major poet who was born here and lived most of her life in New York City. Jesus lost. Do you know this picture? Asks the magazine. Yes, I've seen this man before. I'm sure that clean bronze brow, those dark eyes' intensity surprised me in the blank, sterile whiteness of junior Sunday school. Solomon's Jesus had both the sorrow and the sensuality of the sinner and the passion of saving grace. He's the Jesus of my childhood. But he's lost now. They're looking for him, the advertisement says, or looking for someone who remembers where he hung, at home or school or church, or if still, sometimes at night, he lurches in their hearts. The Jesus on Channel 3 has red hair and cocked eyebrow. He's both sad and sardonic. Yet ain't it more than a little ironic that he's more real than Judge Judy or Geraldo? I like it when he shares the screen with Dragon Lady, who wears a huge hive of dark hair with a lightning streak and a face so soft that the lines in it look like rivers. Solomon's Jesus is masculine in a way that's not yet in style. His smile so deep it is internal, you can see it only in his eyes. This is not ascetic Jesus. He won't please our self-denial. He's a thinker and a feeler, and he requires intimacy as his first and only commandment. Why is Jesus lost? They didn't ask that question on Good Friday or the day of Pentecost. But in the latter day, we just don't know. We cannot seem to find him. Once saw his name and image on a poster. Wanted for anarchy, sedition, vagrancy, conspiracy to overthrow. I look for Jesus in the faces of the children in a sixth grade class, that dark-eyed one with bangs and freckles, her look of reckless tenderness. But I'm confessing that I haven't found him yet, not completely. The ad says scholars want to study him. Perhaps they miss his lost caress. Should he arrive? Should you find him? Copy this address. Valparaiso, Indiana, Box 55. That last little bit, thank you. That last little bit came from, there was an ad, I guess, appeared in religious magazines all over the country. It appeared in Sunstone. And some scholars who were interested in Solomon's Jesus wanted people's experiences with the paintings that Solomon made and asked to send responses to that address in Indiana. Woman, Lady is a word so laden with euphemistic kitsch that it obscures the laughter and the heat and inflicts deletions in the psyche. Females in their 20s, in offices and kitchens, in Phoenix and Wichita, transist from girls to ladies without a fair audition for the leading role of woman. The word may once have had some elegance and grace, but now tastes bogus in the mouths of boys who use it to save face because they can't engage their glacial fear of women. If you're male, please don't introduce me to the little lady until you're eager to be known as little gentleman. I want the passion, intellect, and taste of woman. Anybody who's been going to Sunstone Symposia for many years has been in a whole bunch of hotels in this city. That's where this poem came from. And it reminded me of the time when David O. McKay lived in the Hotel Utah. And I once got to go there for, I can't remember if it was his birthday or something. I went there for the Deseret News. Some photos were taken, etc. And interestingly enough, it was a time when in the Hotel Utah, prostitutes were working there at times. So this poem grew out of all those Sunstone meetings and the curious can't think of the word I want. The ironic juxtaposition of prophets and prostitutes. It's called Eternal Digression. Symposia are rosier in heaven than in hell. In heaven, they're a series of hotels. The women in the corridors wear toreadors and gowns and shorts. Some men wear ties, others jeans with button flies. We are uncorrelated here. Corrugated faces show the pain and character of who we've been, but are devoid of fear. We vibrate to each other's bodies, meanings, minds. We've come to burn some bridges with our friends and all the holy strangers of our past and future lives. In one hotel, God's in the suite called Honeymoon. His prophet is in 504. Call girls whisper past these gilt-edged doors in stocking feet, wade the carpet ankle deep. At 3, room service brings a bite to eat. Beneath the great white beehive, buzz of silence is like ecstasy. Hum of symposium fills the days. Ballrooms are auditoriums where we speak, play, listen to the eddies of our blood. Flood of memory pool at fingertip. We touch each other's lives like relics, pass them, watch as neighbors fondle our regrets. Her chest the sun, her back the moon, goddess rising in a glass-walled elevator. Floating a corridor, I enter the arms of a dark woman in white. In another hotel, I fell from her theological spell to find a daughter of noon who named herself Hope. We dine in a room at the bottom, red-flocked wallpaper and lingerie fashion shows, rows and rows of banquet tables recede in memory, progressive dinners in the Lafayette, the Grand, the Bonneville, beneath tricolored canopy on sloping green. Aftertaste is dream. Chartered buses move us in a night. Interior lights are out, our destination blank. Across the tracks, city of gods, urban underbelly swells with loneliness. All those ballrooms, all those banquet rooms, all those bedrooms, all those hotels. It's a strange poem. That last stanza came from after Sunstone Symposium, I think 3 or 4 years ago. Well, it was probably longer than that. There was a special gathering down at Signature Books, and if you wanted to go, you took a bus, and then you came back and you saw part of the city you don't usually see. Well, I'm shifting to a very different vein here. And Leanna Scott, my wife, is not here this morning because she's working for American Airlines, the 5 a.m. shift. But this is a poem that came out of her airline training in Dallas when she was gone for 5 weeks. It's called Doing Dallas. She's in Dallas, toning that fabulous body with weights and tuning that restless mind with hours of intensity in the classroom. On weekends, I picture her by the pool getting a Texas tan and getting those glances from the cabana boy and her airline buddies. And strange thing, it makes me happy to know that she is glowing in their eyes. That they're surprised she's such a high flyer since she's been grounded almost all her life. If only I were there and could sneak into her room at night, I might, but no, that wouldn't do since her roommate might freak at the indecorum of a date or midnight raid. Yet unrecognized in daylight, behind a pair of shades, reclining in a lawn chair, I'd take a secret joy, along with her friend Micah and the cabana boy, to watch the way she moves her hips. Next week, she's flying home and says she'll flip to see me. I'm imagining a private strip to celebrate the fact that she's done Dallas. This is called Nouveau Riche. I'm on this committee that pitches rich people to donate money for the arts, and it's sort of ironic since I get my hair cut at a dollar shop, and I just signed on for a 30-year mortgage that my new beautiful wife will be shelling out for after I die. The committee asked me to supply names of the affluent who will show up at wine tastings where we will softly squeeze them for big bucks. Although the closest I generally get to wine is the red grapes I take in my sack lunch, which are supposed to help lower my cholesterol. I'm in possession of a secret spreadsheet obliquely titled Gift Chart Potential, which categorizes the wealthy according to how much they might be persuaded to kick in, from $1,000 to $250,000. While some of these folks have the slightly stuffy names that smell of old money, Ezekiel and Edna, Frank and Pamela, the nouveau riche have really spiffy names, such as David and Char, Dick and Timmy, Skip and Matty, Zibby and Jim, Yoko and Larry, and Billy and Betsy. Those are real names, by the way. I'm trying to imagine myself in my best suit, my only suit, but that's not the point, sidling up to Zibby and Jim at a wine tasting, politely waiting while they sniff the bouquet of the Quinta de Novelle Cojeta 1987 single vineyard late bottle vintage port, waiting while they sip, swish, and spit. Chances are they'll notice me, since I'll have an attractive woman on my arm who knows how to dress and will easily slip into casual talk about our mutual interests as patrons of the arts. When it's time to make the pitch, what if I slip and suggest they skip the formalities and adopt an impoverished poet? They could commission me to write odes to George W.'s tax cuts. It's the life I was meant to lead. Thank you. We will now go through the same order and read some works of Mae Swanson.
I suppose you all know of my illustrious sister's great fame. I would never try to borrow her celebrity or bask in her glory. The fact is, I wither in her poetic light and fervor. She was a wonderful big sister. She didn't stay around very long. She was 23 when she left for New York. I was 21. So we just knew her by her work and by her wonderful letters. I've chosen two or three things. It's hard to choose among Mae's works. I have so many favorites. I'd like to try to read three. I hope I can do them some justice. Question. Body, my house, my horse, my hound. What will I do when you are fallen? Where will I sleep? How will I ride? What will I hunt? Where can I go without my mount, all eager and quick? How will I know in thicket ahead is danger or treasure, when body, my good bright dog, is dead? How will it be to lie in the sky without roof or door and wind for an eye, with cloud for shift? How will I hide? This is one I fell in love with long ago. It was one in her first published collections. And in fact, she named the collection from this poem, A Cage of Spines was the name of the collection. The name of this is The Red Bird Tapestry. Now I put on the thimble of dream to stitch among leaves the red note of his body and fasten here the few beads of his song. Of the tree a cage of gilded spines to please his scarlet, to palace his scarlet, cathedral his cry, and a ripple from his beak I sew, a banner bearing seven studs, this scarf to be the mourning that received his stain. I do with thought instead of actuality, for it has flown. With glinting thimble I pull back, that freak of scarlet to his throne. To worship him, enchanted cherry to a tree that never bore such fruit, who tore the veil of possibility and swung here for a day. A never-colored bird, a never-music heard, who doubly wandered then, looped away. To find in hollow of my throat his call, and try his note on all the flutes of memory, until that clear jet rinses me that was his single play. For this I wear his daring and his royal eye. Now perfected, arrested in absence, my needle laid by and spread my hand, his claws on stems of my fingers fastened, rooted my feet and green my brow, I drink from his beak, the seven beads dropping. I am the cage that flatters him now.
Well, this has been kind of exciting for me. I was wondering whether this was going to go right over on the floor. Aunt May was just my aunt. I didn't realize who she was until much later. And I'm just going to read a couple of her little things here, but I will argue with Roy. I believe May's poetry is different than what Roy writes, and I don't know anybody who can write the way my Uncle Roy writes, and it's very refreshing and interesting and tantalizing. And I think May just has a different flavor, a more zippity, kind of a peppermint, I would say. And May's got the deep chocolate. This is called a Navajo blanket. Eye dazzlers the Indians weave. Three colors are passed that pull you in and pin you to the maze. Brightness makes your eyes jump, surveying the geometric field. Alight and enter any of the gates of blue, of red, of black. Be calmed and hooded, a hawk brought down, glad to fasten to the forearm of a chief. You can sleep at the center, attended by sun that never fades, by moon that cools. Then, slipping free of zigzag and hypnotic diamond, find your way out by the spirit trail, a faint green thread that secretly crosses the border where your mind is rinsed and returned to you like a white cup. This is the exchange. Now my body flat, the ground breathes, I'll be grass. Populous and mixed is mind, earth take thought, my mouth be moss. Field, go walking. I, a disc, will look down with seeming eye. I will be time and study to be evening. You world, be clock. I will stand, a tree here, never to know another spot. Wind, be motion. Birds, be passion. Water, invite me to your bed.
This poem was written a long time ago. It was written the year I was born, before May went to New York City. And it is called A Day Is Laid By. A day is laid by. It came to pass. Wind is drained from the willow. Dusk interlaces the grass. Out of the husk of twilight emerges the moon. This the aftermath of jaded sunset, of noon, and the sirens of bees. Day and wrath are faded. Now above the bars of pastures, of lonely pastures, looms the sacred stars. The year that May received the MacArthur Fellowship, she learned of it while she was in Logan. She was there to receive an honorary degree, an honorary doctorate degree from Utah State University. And while there in a campus hotel, she was working on this poem, which combines the images of her receiving of that honorary degree with her baptism many, many years earlier. And the name of the poem is My Name Was Called. I didn't know what would be done with me when my name was called. As when baptized for the first time, a stiff black four-cornered hat on, afraid it would fall off, my ears stuck out but couldn't grab to keep it steady on my head, slippery and small. Wet and white, the slick enameled chair, its patterns of holes in the metal seat where the water drained. My spotted hand went up to help to bring the velvet investiture over my square-hatted head. Awkward, old bauble with straight short hair, lashless eyes and smileless mouth. My name was called. Heavy medallion on wide blue ribbon hung, swinging from my neck. The elder's white robe sloshed at his knees. He held my wrists to my chest, backwards pressed me under, dipped me blind in the marble font under green-veined water. My name was called. My 8-year-old head didn't know what would be done. Old, teetering, monkey-like, baby-like head, under gold-tasseled, stiff-plattered-like hat. 60 years later, the naked ears stick out. My name is called. Pulled up out of the deafening bubbles, boosted up to sit in the white chair, murmured over my head the rapid redundant prayer, wet head bowed beneath the hands, laid heavy there, warm, suggestively wet, my white ruffled panties streamed in the slick seat, the silk and velvet lifted, my spotted hand went up, awkward, huge in merciless light, my face on TV in front of my actual face, my little ignorant, ugly, patient, helpless head on screen, the freshest horror, the greatest honor, forced to confront but not forced to smile, child eyes behind old pouched, lashless eyes, never again able to soften the truth of my future face. Face immersed but still afloat over the years. Head pressed under and blessed. Pulled up and invested.
I didn't know what would be done in the white dress or in the black when my name was called. Thank you very much. The time is up, but my brother Roy says he wants to read something else, and if you guys don't have to hurry to the next session, you may stay. I don't think this part will be on the tape, but oh well. Thank you.
It's just as well that I forgot this third one that I meant to share with you. I beg your indulgence. It really fits better at the end. This is May's The Wonderful Pen. I invented a wonderful pen, not a typewriter. I wanted to use just one hand, the right. With my hand always bent, the ink tube, a vein in my wrist, fixed between finger and thumb, the pen wrote as fast as I could feel. It chose all the right words for my feelings. But then, my feelings ran out through the pen. It went dry. I had a book of wonderful feelings, but my right hand was paralyzed. I threw away the pen. I invented a dream camera, a box with a visor or mask like a stereopticon. When I awoke, I could view and review my dreams, entire, in their depth. Events, visions, symbols, colors without names, dazzled, obsessed me. They scalded my sight. I threw away the camera. I had a moving picture of my wonderful dreams, but I was blind. So with my left hand I wrote. I had been lazy so long. The letters went backwards across the page. Sometimes they went upside down. A Q for a B, a D for a P, or an N for a U, an M for a W, and it got worse. Now, since I can't read or see, not even a mirror can tell me what I mean by the first line by the time I've written the last line. But my feelings are back. And my dreams. What I write is so hard to write, it must be hard to read. So slow, so swift my mind, so stupid my pen, I think I'll invent a typewriter for the left hand and no eyes. No, I throw away the thought. But I have a wonderful mind. Inventive. It is for you to find. Read me. Read my mind.